I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope game for a poem that interests us, some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Dee Morris, who has taught modern and contemporary poetics, including sound art, documentary, and the digital, among whose books are How to Live, What to Do, HD's Cultural Poetics, and Sound States, Innovative Poetics and Acoustical Technologies, and her co-edited collection, New Media Poetics, who has written tons of fabulous essays on writing, the human-machine interface, on HD's time in Philadelphia, on storytellers, on Dickinson, and on oppositional intellectuals. And by Nancy Cool, poet, editor, and curator, whose books of poems, including Suspend, and The Wife of the Left Hand, who is the co-editor of Phylum Press and curator of poetry for the Yale Collection of American Literature at the Beinecke Library, and among whose exhibition catalogs is Intimate Circles, American Women in the Arts. And by Susan Howe, whose many, many books include My Emily Dickinson, The Liberties, Singularities, The Midnight, Souls of the Labadee Tract, a favorite of mine, The Birthmark, and two of my own favorites in addition, The Secret History of the Dividing Line and Melville's Marginalia, among many others, who studied acting in Dublin, who earned a degree from the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, whose writing asks us to focus on the tangible presence of language itself, who deeply admires the poetry of Wallace Stevens, and whose aim with Dickinson, according to Marjorie Perloff, is not so much to explain the poet's meanings as to relive them. Thank you all for coming. Thanks, the two of you coming from Connecticut. Did you share a train?
We did not.
No. If you had, you wouldn't have just stopped talking about Wallace
Stevens. We should have, but we couldn't.
No, you would have said all the things that we're going to say. And Dee, thank you again for coming to New York.
Thank you for the invitation.
Okay. So we're here today to talk about a poem by the aforementioned Wallace Stevens. It's a late meta poem called The Poem That Took the Place of the Mountain. It was collected in Stevens' last group of poems called The Rock. Our recording was made during Stevens' May 1st, 1952 reading at Harvard in the new lecture hall there, now called Lowell, the Lowell Lecture Hall. The original is in two reel-to-reel tapes housed at the Woodbury Poetry Room Lamont Library at Harvard. And we're grateful to Don Cher and Christina Davis, successive directors at the Woodbury, for working with us at Penn Sound to bring the Harvard Stevens recordings to our archive and thus to make them available for everyone everywhere. So here now is Wallace Stevens reading The Poem That Took the Place of the Mountain.
There it was. Word for word. The poem that took the place of the mountain. He breathed its oxygen. Even when the book lay turned in the dust of his table. It reminded him of how he had needed a place to go to in his own direction. How he had recomposed the pines, shifted the rocks, and picked his way among clouds for the outlook that would be right, where he would be complete in an unexplained completion. The exact rock where his inexactnesses would discover, at last, the view toward which they had edged, where he could lie, and gazing down at the sea, recognize his unique and solitary home.
So I'm asking everybody to, I had no idea I was going to ask this question first, but I'm asking everybody to try to remember when they first read this poem or somewhere early in their experience with this poem, because it is a meta poem and it's announced by the title that it's a poem about poetry. So does anybody want to say about one's first experience, or maybe our students' first experience with grappling with this metapoem? Is it a simple poem about poetry, Susan? Do you think it's sort of straightforward in that regard?
I think it's magnificently, complicatedly simple. that he ties that up beautifully. But for me, it's so supremely a late poem. And I read it, particularly my age, as an absolute, I can't remember, because I was far more attracted to the early poems in Harmonium when I first started reading Stevens. So this, to me, I don't think of it in terms of an early poem.
So let's defer for a second talking about the late style, but there is a late style down to the grammar. But let's go a little more with the metapoem. So Nancy D, how do you want to respond to this poem? How would you teach someone this poem as being about poetry or being about a poem, how a poem could take the place of climbing up a mountain or whatever? D, you want to start with that?
You know, after listening to Stephen's reading, I would approach it maybe through sound, because it is as if he's climbing a mountain. He can get the first line of each of these seven couplets, he has two bursts. There it was, word for word. And then the second line of the couplet, three bursts, the poem that took the place of a mountain. So there's almost a breathlessness about it.
It's hard work going back.
It's hard work, and what it replicates in its sound is pick your way through the clouds toward a kind of clarity.
Yeah, I agree, and implicitly with Susan, too. I find the lateness of this moving, and I find the 1952 reading moving, because basically he's doing this work of climbing up this poem, and it's hard and satisfying, and there's a ton of recollection here. Right, but let's stay with metapoem for one second. Nancy, anything to add to that?
A thing I love about this is the way it's not a poem about a mountain. It's a poem about a mountain.
Right.
And that already you enter with a kind of uncertainty about where you're headed, in spite of what I think Susan rightly refers to as a kind of, there's a sense of a simplicity, though it's so complex.
I just think that of the, there it was, the poem that took the place of a mountain, that's just saying, there it is, that's my entire life, there it was, the poem that took the place of everything in life I didn't do, all the great mountains. I mean, I don't think it's climbing mountain, metaphorically a mountain, as the sort of mountain could be. On one level, it could be philosophy, because he's just written the poem to Santayana, and
same year.
He chose poet. Yeah, and in the same group as them. Mm. Anyway, there's some sense of I chose poetry. He chose philosophy. There it was.
Right. And he takes a retrospective view. So he doesn't say, there it is, as some metapoems would. You know, Dickinson, when she's talking about the occupation of this, the thing that she does, is more likely to use a present. Stevens is saying, I've re-encountered a poem, whether it's an actual poem. Yeah. There are plenty of earlier poems about mountains.
Yeah.
So he could be actually encountering, oh, there it was, there's the poem. Or he could, as Susan's suggesting, be encountering the experience of having written such poems.
Yeah, that's what I think it is.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that works toward that for me is the verbs that he uses.
Yeah, we better look at those.
To remind.
Yeah.
To recompose.
Yep.
And then to recognize.
Right.
So it's an act of the mind again and again and again that makes a life.
He says that it, past tense, reminded him of how he had needed, how he had recomposed the pines. Why switch to the past perfect at that point. Is that what it is?
Well, it's very interesting because then he goes into the subjunctive.
I know, yeah, and I was going to go there next. But before we confuse it even further, so he says, in the past, there is the poem I used to write, or there's the poem I encounter now of the past. And this poem reminded me of how I had once been what? What would we say? I had once been a poet who needed to find my way.
Well, for one thing, I can never stop thinking about him, that he never went to Europe. Yeah. I mean, that just blows my mind always about Stevens. He never went.
Yeah.
And he's so in love with France and Rome. I mean, the old philosopher. And he never went there.
Right.
So I always think, I take it to mean that took the place of life, of a life that...
So instead of life, I had a poem.
But that was life. That is life. That's the thing. Mm. That is life for him.
So recomposing the pines would mean not encountering pines or chopping down pines or walking through pines, but composing them as I would write them.
Right.
It reminded me of how I had written pines rather than been with pines, in pines.
Yeah, I think there are also references... I don't want to get too academic.
No, go ahead. Get heavy a little bit.
I think there are references to Chikorawa. Chikorawa to its neighbor.
To its neighbor.
Which is his mountain poem. Right. But it's a mountain poem.
It has been argued that is a poem that deals with romanticism and the influence of romanticism.
But you can't think of Chikorawa without thinking of William James.
Right.
Or I can't. And therefore the Jameses.
This is a New Hampshire mountain, we should stipulate.
That was William James's home.
Right.
So it's so Jamesian. I mean, there's this short story of James's, The Altar of the Dead, where he recomposes the candles in, I mean, it's almost, he's almost, it echoes that James story.
Mm.
And again, with the philosophy thing, and that he, you know, that was what was important to him at Harvard when he went there.
As was something.
That's
honest.
Just me.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's just you.
I
mean, you're not the only one who's read the James in there.
I think that little word, it,
mm-hmm.
is also key in the sort of leading you to Mount Chikorawa.
There it was. Word for word. The poem that took the place of the mountain. He breathed its oxygen, even when the book lay turned in the dust of his table. It reminded him of how he had needed a place to go to in his own direction, how he had recomposed the pines, shifted the rocks, and picked his way among clouds for the outlook that would be right, where he would be complete in an unexplained completion.
So he's climbing the mountain of the old poem, and he is not walking through the pines, but recomposing them. And he's not climbing over rocks, he's shifting them. There's something active about that. And he's picking his way among clouds. So, Nancy, can you speak to this? I mean, what's the activity? How would you describe this activity?
Well, I'm interested in the verbs shifted and picked, too, in addition to the ones that you point out earlier, Dee. But before that, the sentence, or the line, rather, a place to go to in his own direction is a really fascinating one to me, outside or aside from, adjacent to what Susan is saying. Because I'm interested in the way in which it fixes the idea of a place alongside the idea of motion and direction. So there's a kind of a fixed thing and an openness. So both things are kind of happening simultaneously. It's an unusual construction, a place to go to in his own direction.
It's an unusual one for Stevens, a place to go to. He would not normally say that.
Which was home. The
and
dust is, of his table.
And it is home. I mean, in the end, we're kind of jumping to the conclusion, but in the end, he got to this place so that he could see the home from where he came, or at least down at the sea, maybe all of our homes. It's been read as Whitmanian, whether it's true or not. The sea. We all crawl out of the sea.
You know? When you bring up the Whitman, I think that it's very late. This is thy hour, O soul, thy free flight into the wordless. Yeah. That simple, simple Whitman, which away from books, away from art, and then night, sleep, death, and the stars. This is his Whitman, night, sleep, death, and the stars poem.
Oh, yeah.
To me.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, so now somebody, I think it was Nancy, mentioned that we go from he had needed. So you get past tense, then he had needed, and he had recomposed them. And now for the outlook that would be right. So it's really complicated because we're going doubly into the past and then into the subjunctive. Dee, do you want to say anything about this? It's complicated.
Well, one of the things that I love about looking at this poem is the way that he keeps reminding you that a poem is making, that it is a kind of making. So it begins to accelerate. He's very slow with the dust of his table, right? And then it reminded him how he had needed a place to go. And then the response to the need is not to compose, but to recompose. A little bit like Lily Briscoe in To the Lighthouse. Yeah. Move the salt cellar. Yeah. So make a gestalt. To recompose, and then that's not simple. Shifting rocks, especially in this book, the rock.
Yeah. Right.
And picking, it's those sounds, his way among clouds. For the outlook that, and at this moment, what I love about this is he's still doing it for the outlook that would be right. It hasn't closed yet. Although he's looking toward a closure.
For the outlook that would someday be right. For the outlook that could be someday right. Right. Or that would inevitably be right if I could get up to that spot.
Well,
could be any of those things.
Or in this condition of always already not right, our inexactnesses.
Yes.
Nonetheless,
unexplained.
We write
poetry. Exactly. An unexplained completion. That's what he wants. It's always, there's more than can be explained.
Right.
There's always...
Mind is never satisfied, says Stevens.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Nancy, do you want to help us with the exactness, the exact rock, which in the rock is, I mean, rock, the word rock is so important to someone like Stevens because it just says exactitude, but he's very slippery about how exact it's going to be. The exact rock where his inexactness would discover at last the view toward which they had edged. You want to take that?
Well,
do anything with it?
The edging, I think, is fascinating and compelling and suggests something of danger and a kind of, you know, a precipice beyond just the view, but
and
also
usually edged
the...
in this connotation is not dangerous, edging slowly toward a viewpoint. But here, when you're on a mountain... He's also lying, by the way. So he is lying on the edge of... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's dangerous. It's precarious. It's dangerous. There's there are stakes.
And what does he want? What's he willing to risk the danger for?
I'm just thinking about edge and the way in which, as he reads it, his voice falls there toward which they had his inexactness.
And he waits. He waits for edged.
Edged. Yeah. He waits for edged. And then the poem goes flat again, where he could lie, which I think has a kind of doubleness, things up, and gazing down at the sea, which has a kind of doubleness, seeing in the sea. But the heart of the poem is full of the activity of composition, and the end of the poem is the edge of letting go of the act of composing.
Wow.
That's how it sounds like to me. That's what that kind of deep sadness brings me at the end.
So you feel deep sadness here.
I do. I mean, there's an attempt at consolation, unique and solitary home. But it was the poem.
At last, the view toward which they had edged, where he could lie, and gazing down at sea, recognize his unique and solitary home.
So let's talk about lateness. Let's all chime in. Mm-hmm. Susan opened this up, but I think we should talk about it. Stevens has a late style. What evidence do we have in this text in front of us of a late style?
That, what Dee had said, that simplicity, that's sad, that's what, it's, what is it, tragic and yet fulfilling?
I was thinking of, you know, on the way walking here, that the thing for me is that it's austere.
It's spare. Yes, great. That's true.
But you're so grateful.
Right. Yeah.
But grateful, but accepting of everything that's there. So there's a double move, I think.
Yeah.
A closing that for him in these late poems feels so much like an opening.
Yes.
Which is also a letting go.
So if somebody erased my bibliographic or poem by poem bibliographic memory of Stevens' poems, which is hard to erase in my head at this point, and said, here's a poem, is it late or early? I would know instantly this is late. And I guess what I'm asking the four of us who know Stevens, give us some more.
Okay, I'm going to give you one little more thing.
I want
it. I just did this turned in the dust of his table.
Yes.
Now, I just in the fact that Stevens loved the dictionary and he constant, I mean, this may be very austere, but it's also wordplay. The man could not be, when he says C, it could be the letter C. And anyway, when you think about turned in the dust of his table, is it turned over face down? Does the word dust bring up dust to dust?
It does.
It does bring it up.
Sure.
And
especially
it's,
after
is it,
word for word.
So is it just simply that he turned the book over, or it sort of lay down dust to dust, ashes to ashes, over, or
I have an
what?
Answer to that
I mean,
question,
that's but it's
but
very.
I wanna,
the end is there. The tomb is
first.
There.
Oh, I totally agree. I want to hear answers to the question, but I definitely am excited about an answer. Go ahead.
Well, I also just want to point out. I mean, that it's a beautiful image of the book as a mountain. Also,
that's true.
Which is
you're right,
almost
Nancy.
Too obvious
oh,
to,
right.
stay,
yeah,
to say.
Exactly.
Right. But
absolutely.
So the book on the table is itself a mountain.
That's right.
Another thing about the word turned is that it also is verse and reverse. Trope.
Yes.
So, and turning as a craftsman might turn.
Yes. It's also a psalmist's word.
I turn
change,
to.
About life change.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's life change, a seasonal change. All right, here's my little story. I imagine either a sadness, a refusal, a turning away from bookishness, a turning away from poems in books. So, normally you would think, there it was, the poem I wrote years ago in the book that is open in front of me. But what we get here is there it was, word for word. It's not in the book. The book has been turned away. There's something really fantastic, fantasy-like, about living a life of poetry, but imagining that you turned away from the book and climbed up the mountain of the imagination, and then in the end had your poem. Dee, you wanted to say something in response.
Well,
to
no, that. You're making me think of Domination of Black.
Much
the
earlier
colors
poem, yes.
turned in and the turned.
Yeah, right. So
and that really works here in that also the sense of turn into, become
transformation
through meditation, come to a kind of vitality.
Yeah,
it's just
Nancy.
Sort of speaking toward the vitality, the oxygen, the idea of the oxygen, this creation of what is atmospheric, too, seems to me to be important.
It's such a wonderful word.
It is.
Yeah. Oxygen.
Yeah.
He breathed.
And he
not
says
its
it well.
Air, not its spirit. It's oxygen.
Yeah. It's all about, I'm old, but I'm getting all the way up there. And I'm going to breathe deeply. This is a breathe deeply poem. All right, so help me with outlook. Now, that is not a word. I've read all of Stevens' business letters and every, I mean,
okay,
this is
I
not
got
a word.
One. I
this
got,
is not
I
a
can,
word he would have normally used, so he really thought of it. Go ahead, Susan.
I can come up with something.
Go ahead.
Because I read it somewhere else. Someone else was. He read, you can find echoes of the poet Henry Vaughan. throughout late Stevens. Mm-hmm. And Dear Butte, this is a Vaughan poem, the one about we are all going into a world of light I alone sit.
Most famous poem.
Yeah, that's probably his most famous poem. Okay, well, one of those verses here. Dear beauteous death, shining nowhere but in the dark, what mysteries lie beyond thy dust could man outlook that mark? There he's
How
used
is outlook
both
used there?
Dust
That's unusual.
And outlook.
Yeah.
Well, when you go to look up outlook in the dictionary, that's how, because Stevens always did
a
go
fabulous look. Fabulous archaism. Outlook meaning to overlook, to
look
outdo
farther,
a look,
yeah,
to outdo a
yeah,
look.
That's
oh
one
my
of
God,
its
I
many.
Never thought of that.
Could man out, but when you find both outlook and mark in that famous and dust, I mean,
yes.
In that thing, they are all gone into a world of light.
Susan Howe, you've done it. I knew why you traveled from Connecticut. That's pretty great.
No, but I think, Dee, you're totally right about Virginia Woolf. When you bring up Virginia Woolf and To the Lighthouse, echoes of To the Lighthouse, the same mood in The Lighthouse of this terrible sadness and love and home and just... And the painter, Lily, working, and the last word in the thing being vision. I mean, so...
And just that literal gesture as she shifts the salt cellar to a different part of the table, and that completes the painting.
There you
so
go.
So these little shifts become the turn, the verse, the move from dust to word.
Well, we could go on and on and on and on about this. I could tell just looking at you all. So what I want to do is go around once and get sort of one last thought, just something that you want on the record for those who are listening to this and encountering Stevens' late poems maybe for the first time, would need to hear that we forgot to add. So, Dee, you look like you've got some extra thing you want to say.
One of the things that really seized me in rereading The Rock was the place of emptiness and vacancy. The fact that emptiness and vacancy is a fullness. It's a little bit like when you stop talking, you know, the cage thing, you can hear the music all around,
right.
The sound all around it.
Right.
The Rock ends with the little start of a cry. Is it a squawk?
The bird cry.
Yes.
The sea, the chorister whose sea preceded the choir. Yeah.
That's right. And it's that sound that you hear when you stop talking, only when you stop talking. Mm. So for me, that's part of the balance, the end of this.
Thank you, Dee. Nancy?
Oh, I would just add, and I think along the same lines, and we talked a little bit, and you certainly pointed to some wonderful examples, Dee, of the sound of the language of this poem, too. I think we didn't spend as much time, certainly, as we could have, talking about how that informs the reading and how it resonates kind of physically at the same time as well. So I would add that.
Thank you, Nancy. Susan?
I don't know what to say. But Dee, when you just said that... you didn't say the word nothingness, did you? But just sort of edging towards, I thought instantly, of course, the snowman.
Yes.
And, that sense of nothingness as, it's like negative theology in a way, that nothingness is holy, there's a choir is one of the last... word. I mean, these things, actually, these late poems to me are holy. I honestly feel they're holy, even though some writer said Stevens is my religion. Some famous English novelist
someone said that of you.
Someone said that of herself. Famous English novelist, they said, well, what is your religion? She's one of the, now I can't remember her name. And she said, Wallace Stevens is my religion. And there's something religious.
Mm.
I kept thinking, you know, going through The Rock for this time, that really what I always hear is the psalm at the end.
The
of
psalm.
The psalm
at the end of the psalm.
There
you
are.
I hear the psalm. The psalm. Yes, absolutely. I do too.
Of mere being. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to throw out my final word or last thought here, and it has to do with also a late moment in Stevens, where he explores in another poem what might happen if we come to the end of the imagination. Now, Stevens is such a champion of the imagination, even at this somewhat diminished point. I've mentioned Emily Dickinson earlier, but I can only think of Emily Dickinson as equally a champion of the imagination. And so when Stevens gets to the point where he's at the end of the imagination and the lines get a little longer, it's a different kind of poem here, the lines get a little longer and he's sort of not sure he can choose the right adjective for this blank cold,
which he does so well with blank,
the word blank. You cold. Did it fine, Wallace. You still got it. And then he discovers that the end of the imagination itself had to be imagined, he says. And that is a great moment of resurgence. And the poem does its job to the end after that. A little bit slightly pat, like this one. There's a reading of the end of this poem is slightly pat, like, you know, I got to the thing and I saw what I was intending to see, my origins, and this the circle of life and all that stuff. But the fact is, the key moment is where he realizes that all I have to do is get really old and start thinking about death, and I realize that until I'm actually dead, I have as much capacity to imagine as I did when I was young, and watch me do it more maturely. Watch me do that imagining more maturely. And this is a poem where he's declaring, I can write a poem that does the work of mountain climbing. I can write a poem that stands for mountains. Just watch an old man do it. Well, thank you. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, or all three if you're quick. And I forgot to remind you of this, so you're winging it, to spread wide our narrow hands, to gather a little something poetically good to hail or commend someone or something or some project or some book going on in the poetry world. And I forgot to ask you to prepare this, and so you're really just going to wing it. Dee, what's going on that you would like?
What I
a
love.
Book, a poet?
It's Tyrone Williams' little reviews that he's been doing in Jacket 2.
In Jacket 2, yes.
He's been embodying the reader in just a way that
I think he's been reading constantly.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
So you would just go to jacket2.org and you would click on commentaries and look for Tyrone Williams. That's terrific. And did you know that Tyrone is going to be the subject of an upcoming poem talk? So some great poems by him. Nancy Cool.
I'll just mention the book I was reading on the train, which is by a poet I don't know well. Her name is Brooklyn Copeland. The book is called Siphon Harbor, I believe. It's from 2012, from Shearsman Books.
It's quite lovely. C-O-P-E-L-A-N-D?
I believe so. If you don't mind, I'll reach in my book.
No, that's great. You can follow up. Here it is.
Brooklyn Copeland, C-O-P-E-L-A-N-D, and the book is indeed called Siphon Harbor. I got that right.
Terrific. Thank you. Susan Howe, Gather Some Paradise.
Mine is Echolalia. It's not a book of poetry, but it's Echolalia's On the Forgetting of Language by Daniel Heller Rosen, which I think all poets should read. I mean, it isn't a book on poetry, but it is.
And we all to some
poetry.
Degree, have Echolalia.
Yeah, we all.
So I want to gather some paradise. It's really simple. It's called the Beinecke Library. Now, we have in the room the person who's in charge of the poetry collections there, but it is just amazing. You have to go. You have to email Nancy and, oops, you're going to get a few emails. Email Nancy and say, I want to look at the Stein materials. Rattle off some major poets whose work you have that you would just like people to know about.
Sure, of course. I'm delighted to do so.
Dee and I
were just talking about HD's papers, which are at the Beinecke. We could have also talked about, since we're talking about Stevens, William Carlos Williams. Ezra Pound is another. We, not all that long ago, acquired a wonderful collection of manuscripts of the work of the poet Susan Howe.
Wait a minute. Susan Howe's manuscripts, and I assume early drafts of poems and books.
Indeed. I would say among my most favorite things in that archive, what I think are the most exciting, and I've talked with Susan about this quite a bit, are her notebooks, which bring together both what is on Susan's mind at any moment alongside what she's working on. There are some wonderful examples. I especially like a notebook in which I discovered a drawing of the fragment of the wedding dress of Sarah Edwards, which appears on her the cover of this, and it's a wonderful example of looking at what Susan's looking at in the archive with Susan. That dress fragment is in the Beinecke collections of Jonathan Edwards. So speaking of meta.
Yes, I'm glad this conversation
has
gotten so
recursive. Now I have
recursive.
To go in quickly.
Uh-oh. Oh, meta. Here it comes.
I have to say that Nancy Kuhl, her spirit in the Beinecke Library, the sense of openness, excitement, generosity towards scholars and poets. It's extraordinary compared to other
bizarre
research libraries. It's really
sorry,
bizarre.
Nancy. And, you're blessing, but you know what? The fact is that
true.
We want to declare here and now that a poet who rises to such a position, it means something to the poetry community because you understand what poets do. And so, sorry, this is really a love fest. This is a little ridiculous.
No, but I could.
But wouldn't it be great if one of the results of this Poem Talk conversation, which is already rather unusual, would mean that people who listen to Poem Talk would make the journey to the Beinecke or to your nearby poetry archive, great one at Washington University, great one at the University of California at San Diego, great one at the University of Washington, Seattle, a very fine one here at the University of Pennsylvania.
Not to mention
at
Buffalo.
At the Houghton Library and Buffalo, and so on. People would make their way. They would begin to do what, in fact, Susan Howe at the Houghton when you were dealing with my Emily Dickinson.
No, but they were horrible. I'm going to give it
to
the Houghton.
They were personally back then.
There's no comparison to the Beinecke and the Houghton.
But what I'm saying as a scholar
and
who likes
to go
to
the
archive, it's on the air. We can't get it off. But as a scholar archivist myself, I realize that looking at those materials means that the next article or essay or book that you write about, to use Susan as an example, about Susan Howe, has to take into account the things she was drawing, the things she was clipping out of the newspaper, if we have those things, and the early drafts. And that's what's so great about this work. We want to integrate the discussion of poetry in a somewhat formalistic way with the work of the archivist, which is providing us materials that gives us historical and bibliographical and other illogical ways of approaching. So that's all the Write Outlook we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Dee Morris, Nancy Kuhl, and Susan Howe, and to our engineer, Zach Cardiner, and our editor, Allison Harris. Next time on Poem Talk, Julia Block, Annette Debo, and once again, Dee Morris will talk with me about five sections of H.D.'s book, Helen in Egypt, based on a recording made in 1955 by another Yale Beinecke guy, H.D.'s executor, Norman Holmes Pearson. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.